Hello, Bill.
Hello, Matt. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Welcome back.
Back from my respite. You've had your respite. Hopefully,
yes.
Our batteries are both fully charged.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Let me just before we forget, I want to give a shout out and a thank you to Justin Green,
yes,
from the Washington Examiner, who filled in for both of us, and I think quite ably. Did a great job. Also, I want to give a shout out to our friend Bill Buettler, who a former guest host of the DM, actually of the Weekend Blog, the former name of this fine program, who just did a dive vlog on technology.
Oh, great.
So we'll see. That would check that out as well.
Great,
good stuff.
Now you did you go to your usual summer cooling spot of Arizona?
I did. You know, about a month and a half ago, we were in Orange County, California for a week, and then we went up to LA. I did real time. So we got our beach time. But every August, we like to go to Arizona, where it is hot and you're in the desert. And
they have the finest air conditioning, I understand.
Well, they don't just have air conditioning. They have, like, you'll go out to a restaurant or wherever, a mall, and there are these little, like, I don't know what they're called. They spritz water at you. So you're outside, but there's these little, like, water spritzers that are just putting, like, I'm sure there's a name for these things that people in the Southwest would know what it is, but it keeps you cool. And if you're by the pool, look, I wouldn't want to be a construction worker in Phoenix in August, but if you're at the pool, it's not bad.
All right.
And I read, and reading, I love reading, and you're sitting by the pool, you're reading, and I think it's so important to, I just had this big, you know, Ed Morrissey, my friend, and the great Ed Morrissey from hotair.com in the week, he and I just had this really good conversation on my podcast, check it out, where we talk about the need to unplug. He went on Twitter during Lent last year. We talked about the importance of honoring the Sabbath. And how that could keep you sharp. And I'm also a big believer, you know, vacations. Andrew Sullivan, who is a master blogger, whether you like him or not, and has been active a long time, takes the vacations. He gets away from it. He has guest blog. I had guest bloggers fill in for me, Bill. And frankly, they did great. Some really good folks, and kept the site fresh and got some, you know, web traffic while I was at the pool.
Showing you up?
You know what? I think they raised my level. And they made me, you know, it was funny, looking at my blog, because, you know, we all fall into habits and get into ruts. And I was looking at my blog with my name on it, you know, and seeing headlines and topics that I would never have written about. And I'm like, why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I have written this? And it sort of was, invigorating to see that. And I'm very thankful. But it also gave me, you know, I'm not afraid that anybody's going to take my job, which, you know, it's just like being a quarterback, you know, you always have to look over your shoulder. If people are stupid enough to pay you to blog or write, you do have to be a little bit worried about job security, but I'm not because I'm so awesome, let's be honest. I work in a really loyal place, and basically you don't lose your job because of injury. So I wasn't worried about that, but it is nice to know that you can go on vacation and your blog will still be fed, that your readers won't abandon you because of lack of content. Andrew Sullivan, like I said, has been doing this for years. I think it's the first time I've done it, maybe. Last year I ran Best of Pieces. So it was great. I mean, how about you, Bill? Like, were you psychologically, you were off last week. How did you psychologically deal with unplugging?
I agree. Good to unplug, and I like to have some space to do reading. Although I being sort of in this world and having a one track mind, I don't completely unplug. I mean, I did bring my Woodrow Wilson biography with me, which I got to finish on vacation.
Cool.
And And so it was nice to be able just to, I usually read in like 2-3 page increments. So it's nice to, read a couple of chapters at once. And
we've already been over the fact that you mostly do your reading in the bathroom.
That's right. That's the only way. When you're a parent with young children, you take your free time where you can. I just saw the movie This Is 40, where, that's where he gets his online Scrabble in. That's just, you take what you can get. But as I was reading the Wilson, and Syria was heating up, it just continually struck me as I was reading the parallels that I was seeing between the run up to Wilson's entry into World War I and Obama's approach to Syria, and lo and behold,
this is utterly fascinating on two counts. One, the actual idea is fascinating, and two, I try to study ideas. Where do good ideas come from? I think Stephen Johnson had a book by that title. He was also on my podcast. Check that out. I'm a fan of Brain Pickings, the Twitter feed and the website, and it studies like where do good ideas come from, and a lot of inventions and creative things are a result of something happening in the world and someone else reading history and putting those two things together and seeing a connection. It's not that you've invented something entirely original. It's taking two different things and finding the connection between them. So it's cool that worked out for you. And I find that that's how I come up with content a lot of times too. So tell us, how is this like? And by the way, let me say, this maybe isn't, I don't know that this is a good analogy. I mean, I don't know, this is not a favorable analogy if you're Barack Obama.
Well, I don't think it's either favorable or unfavorable. I don't think it preordains the outcome of what happens, but I do think it's a fallacy to look at this through the prism of Bush and say, Obama's now going to go into his own dumb war. He condemned Bush for doing a dumb war in Iraq. He, as one Fox News columnist said, he is going to bypass the UN apparently, and Bush bypassed the UN. So now he's a hypocrite and a fraud. I think those are way too simplistic parallels because.
Well, but people remember the Iraq War. They don't know about, what led up to World War One.
Well, so
you'll forgive them for making the facile metaphor, right?
Well, because what's not similar with Bush is the foreign policy vision the two have aren't changing. It's not like Obama is shedding his liberal foreign policy and wrapping himself up in neoconservatism, looking to delegitimize the UN, bring back Pax Americana, establish permanent military bases in the heart of the Middle East. But it's not what's going on here. Maybe you need to unbelieve that and have a larger conspiracy going on in your mind, but there's certainly no evidence to that end. What you have is the same foreign policy that he's had, but being implemented, differently in case by case. The way he handled Libya was different than how he handled Egypt, and the way he's handled Iran is different than how he's handling Syria. What you're seeing is, like Wilson, someone whose foreign policy is in part a deep reluctance to go into war, not rushing headlong, biding time, trying to draw some lines, trying to find negotiated settlements, trying to be a peace broker. Wilson, when World War One, lit up in 1914, even after the Lusitania was sung in 1915, which if you read, and I was reading the book by John Milton Cooper, Woodrow Wilson, a biography, which I would, as an aside, Matt, if you like to see how ideas originate, that is a great book to read, because it's all about how the origin of Wilson's ideas, and he has so much documentation of his trajectory that you really get a flavor, because he wasn't on a very linear track. in his life. So you see a lot of the twists and turns and what was going on in his brain. And so I think you'd find, and there's a lot of Burke. I know you like Burke. So I think you'd enjoy the book, even if you're not going to end up being a Wilson fan at the end of it. So anyway, Wilson was trying to establish America as the neutral peace broker who was going to not only end the war, but move the world towards more democracy, move the world towards more international conflict resolution with the League of Nations. And he felt that by being out of the war, he'd be in the best position to do that. And it was only when Germany, and they had this whole dance with Germany about these submarine attacks in the Atlantic Ocean where Americans kept getting killed. And even though, you know, it wasn't like Bush and 9/11 where the day after Americans were demanding revenge and Wilson took them straight in. I mean, Wilson, it was 2 years after the Lusitania was sunk until America went in, and there were other submarine attacks and lots of diplomatic kabuki between America and Germany. And there was a re-election where Wilson won on the slogan, he kept us out of war, which not only applied to Europe, but also Mexico, because Mexico had deteriorated into civil war. It actually spilled over into America briefly. Wilson was credited for not leaping in with both feet and getting into a border war with Mexico. And it was only shortly after the re-election when he just won on this slogan. He wins re-election in November. In January, he gives a big speech to the Senate, the Peace Without Victory address, where he even fully fleshes out his vision of America as peace broker, how we could have peace between the Allies and Germany without one side winning definitively. We could have a negotiated settlement and we can do territorial readjustments and move us away from colonization towards self-determination, yada, yada, yada. And it's a month after that where it becomes discovered that Germany has sent a secret cable to Mexico offering an alliance against America and offering Mexico, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona upon victory.
Right.
And it's even 2 months after that when Wilson actually decides to go to war. He doesn't even make a rash decision at that point. He really did not want to go to war. But at the end, he felt he had to. So that's not a flip flop. That is a tactical adjustment, a major one, obviously, in face of changing circumstances. But he still held to the peace without victory vision. He didn't go in and say, "Well, now I'm going to crush Germany and make the and steal all their land." He stuck to that vision, even though the Allies didn't. And he tried very virulently to forge that agreement. I mean, they did have the Treaty of Versailles. But he did accelerate the end of the war without Germany being crushed, much to the dismay of Teddy Roosevelt and the Republicans, and the dismay of the Allies. And so Wilson was able to do what he wanted up to that point, and then where he fell down the job was the actual treaty was not as even-handed as he wanted it to be. It was very harsh towards Germany. He got the League of Nations in the treaty. He couldn't sell it back home, and he lost in the Senate. So you could stop there and say Wilson was foolish. And then if you're going to go apply to Obama, well, Obama is in a similar way. He is the reluctant warrior. He's not trying to go into war after war. He clearly held out with Syria as long as he felt it was possible, without hurting American legitimacy and legitimacy of international law. Both Wilson and Obama had rhetorical missteps in the run-ups as they try to walk this fine line between staying out of war, but trying to draw some firm lines to deter bad behavior. After Lusitania was sunk, Wilson said America is too proud to fight, which was kind of an off-the-cuff comment. And Wilson said soon afterwards that he didn't mean it, as we would never, ever, ever go into war. And he recalibrated his comments soon after. But that line stuck in people's minds. This is Obama's red line about chemical weapons stuck as soon as he said it. And apparently that was not a scripted moment. And you know, both Wilson and Obama could be charged with, you know, you are giving your enemies the incentive to keep attacking because you are showing an inability to follow through on your any deterrent. But both were simply trying to walk a fine line, and they're human beings, and even when you're walking a fine line, you're gonna wobble a little bit. It doesn't mean that your entire foreign policy gets obliterated. Wilson recalibrated, and Obama's recalibrated. So Obama's now at the verge of going in, but like Wilson, still wants to be the peace broker. His team is still saying this is not about regime change. We're not going to use military strikes to directly oust Assad. We still think the final solution here is a negotiated settlement between the parties, which is essentially a type of power sharing. You know, they say they want Assad out, but they're not saying they want all of Assad's people out. So it's very analogous to what Wilson was going for. Once you understand that, you can say, okay, is Obama falling into the same pit where he won't be able to get the negotiated settlement, won't be able to, extend the Arab Spring, or can you look at, okay, where did Wilson go wrong? Because Wilson still got kind of close. It's not like the whole thing. It's not like he lost the war. It's not like he had no treaty at all. Can you pinpoint where he went wrong? Or simply say, look, these are just, they're not completely analogous. I mean, Syria is not all of Europe. They don't have all the same, you know, sub-issues you have to deal with. Are there other things that he could do to avoid those pitfalls?
I think the big problem with the analogy is not with Obama being Wilson, but is with Syria being Europe, and the fact that, you know, the problem obviously is that if you topple Assad, it's very likely that Al-Qaeda or Islamists take over Syria. So that's like the real problem. I mean, that's fundamentally the problem with intervention, certainly with regime change. And that wasn't, I mean, you know, I think in Europe, you didn't face the same problem.
No, that's definitely different, but it does speak to why Obama is not just taking Assad for that exact reason. He doesn't want to just, like, let's just be with the rebels and beat Assad and that'll be the end of it, because what you might get in response is not just that it's Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda is bad, but Al-Qaeda would not be representative of the Syrian people. And you want to have the whole point is to have governments that are reflective of their people, and in doing so, hopefully you have more reasonable international partners that don't want to blow you up.
Right. I want to raise this analogy too. You know, famously in the run-up to World War I, you had the yellow press, the muckrakers, people egging on, yellow journalism, egging on the run-up to war. And I am sensing a similar thing. I mean, I've felt this before, twice, before Desert Storm and before the Iraqi invasion in 2003. And it feels similar. Now, I know public opinion is really against intervention. But you've got Obama, who did say the red line comment. So he wants to save face. He has an incentive to look tough because, as we've talked about many times here, Bill, Obama has sort of reversed the stereotype that Republicans were the party of strong national defense and security and foreign policy. So Obama has incentives to do something. Some sort of a limited strike. And I think you have, despite the fact that the American public isn't in favor of this, I feel like, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the press is like really excited. I mean, the coverage that I see about this, and it's not whether or not their journalists are supporting intervention, it's the fact that they're sort of gleefully covering this exciting event. It reminds me of like when a snowstorm is about to hit Washington, D.C., and the meteorologists get all giddy and excited about it. I mean, I sense a sort of excitement about this, and I wonder if that might not be sort of enhancing the drumbeat of, you know, egging on Obama into doing something that, frankly, is being done maybe, you know, not for the right reasons. That's my concern.
Well, I think the snowstorm analogy is apt. I mean, I think journalists get excited by big events. You know, and war correspondents, sort of like the most glorious type of journalism that is, in the views of some. You know, it's just rich with drama. But this doesn't feel to me like a railroading into it. I don't think the media is squashing all counter argument to going in right now. And you know, I don't think anyone's getting Dixie chicked at the moment for raising dissents. But I do think there is a level
But you do have this group of you know, sort of neocons like by Bill Kristol and Karl Rove and others who are urging a strike. You have Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post basically calling for regime change. You have liberals, I believe Eugene Robinson among them, saying, well, history says we shouldn't do this, but Obama needs to show himself. I mean, this is the beginning, but I sense some of the same, and it's August, and we need content, we need things to write about, we need things to put on TV, and I sense this sort of exciting coverage of this event, which I fear, coupled with Obama's, the fact that, you know, he did create the whole red line mess, and now it's like, well, if you threaten to pull a gun on somebody, you sort of have to, you know, follow through with it. Not get involved in this only to save face and to generate, you know, ratings.
Well, I mean, from the media perspective, I mean, don't you think part of the coverage has been what a giant train wreck this might be? It's not just like even Bush won, and you know the run up to the initial Iraq war, where it was like, this is the puniest army in the world, and we're going to go crush them with the boot of our heel. I sense great anxiety in the media about what this might mean. I mean, obviously there are some commentators out there that are really agitating for it, but I don't think that's uniform in the media.
I agree, Bill. It's not uniform, and it's not as egregious as it has been before. I mean, we're only a decade removed, so some people have memories. Having said that, I'm surprised by the people who I think ought to know better, who are now saying, yeah, but it's a humanitarian crisis. Yeah, but America has to be involved. Yeah, but he used chemical weapons. Yeah, but I really am surprised by people who are not dismissing this out of hand, and who are in some cases seem to be, I don't want to say cheerleading for this. And maybe it's just my perception. That's why we have these conversations. You help me.
All the people you named are people who were diehard for Bush Jr.'s Iraq war on similar ground. So I think they have incentive to say, all you people that mocked us for screwing the pooch in Iraq, we want to go out there and show that Obama is following the same criteria that our guy did, and these are good standards for America to be following. I think they have great incentive to do what it is they're doing and to downplay criticism. Now, you obviously have another strain of conservative thought is, you know, we should be much more restrained about these matters. You know, any kind of government intervention can go wildly awry. You saw in Iraq, let's not have conservatism be sullied by diving in, you know, leading with their chins in every, you know, messy international situation out there. So I assume, and I think you've reflected this in some of your tweeting regarding what conservative talk show hosts have been saying, how it's kind of all over the map right now. And on the left, yeah. I know there are folks on the left who are going to say this is Iraq redux and this is crazy that Obama's going to sully his whole legacy by getting us another quagmire. And you're going to have folks, I wouldn't call myself a cheerleader for this operation, but folks like me who are going to say, you know, this is not Iraq. I'm not making any prediction that it's going to go swimmingly or anything like that, but I think it's understandable why Obama's doing this. And I don't think it is analogous to what happened in Iraq. I think he's on a different foreign policy path. So I see right. these splits in both parties and both ideologies on the subject. And presuming the strike's going to happen, you know, the proof's going to be, you know, what actually happens there. But I think at minimum, it is useful to lay out what the underlying vision and strategy is and debate it on that and not just make the knee-jerk parallels to the most recent event we were aware of, because I don't really think it's apt.
No, I think you're totally right. So let me just sort of lay out some of my concerns and thoughts about it. So I think that, okay, first of all, there are legitimate arguments for doing this, okay? Assad's a horrible person. There are humanitarian concerns. I think it is in the best interest of America and the international community to send a message that the use of chemical weapons will not be tolerated, not only because we said it was a red line, but just because that's, should be a policy.
I mean, and it is a treaty that we have all signed that we don't do this.
Right. So irrespective of Obama's comments, that would still exist. Also, this, toppling Assad would deal a blow to Russia, would deal a blow to Iran, and those are good things. Also, right now there's a problem where refugees are flooding into Jordan, and that's a very tenuous situation. There are arguments for intervening. I think, to me, at the end of the day, the fact that Al-Qaeda would likely emerge, or some sort of Islamist regime would emerge if you were to topple Assad, means that it's not worth spilling an ounce of American blood or spending American treasure to do it. Now, the compromise seems to be some sort of a, quote, limited airstrike that would be punitive. So the goal would not be to topple Assad, but to just punish him and send a message. The assumption would be that this would be a deterrent. But here's the problem. What if, instead of being deterred and cowed, what if Assad doubles down and says, okay, now it's game on. We're going to use more chemical weapons. So then what will we do? Would we have to do some sort of an invasion to get the chemical? I mean, so that's how we could be potentially drawn into something. That's how things escalate. And that's the real fear, why I think it's a little bit dangerous to think that we could have some sort of a, quote, surgical strike that would be very safe. And but what say you to that, Bill?
Well, I mean, the point's correct. I mean, you can't. I mean, this is obviously the kind of paradox as you get into these situations. If you're going to try to deter behavior, you have to be able to prove there will be consequence to your actions. And if you can do it without a military strike, with just the threat of such, if that's enough, great. But once you, anytime you engage the subject and raise the threat, and your bluff is called, if you don't follow through on the threat, then all is lost. So, once you take one step forward, and if that doesn't work, it obviously speaks to what's your next step going to be. I don't know, what exactly escalation would mean in this case. Does it mean wider war? Does it mean getting in more allies? I mean, the actual contours of the initial strike is unknown at this point, so it's hard to say. But obviously, you don't take a step like this without gaming out what might the response be, and what am I prepared to do after that?
Yeah, maybe like the next response is like some sort of a no-fly zone, and then that leads to something else. I'm not an expert. It's hard to say. But I do know that, You have to assume there's a chance you could get sucked in to more and more stuff. And at the end of the day, again, you're fighting over the chance. What are you fighting? What's the benefit? What's the gain?
Right. I mean, I do think
there's a chance that Obama. Let me throw this other historical analogy at you. First, let me make this point before I forget. I think we've bought into the concept of peace through strength. As if it's like written in the Bible. I think peace through strength certainly can work, But that, like, so, but if you 100% buy that doctrine, then you think if we intimidate Assad, he backs down. Well, he might double down instead of backing down. There's also people saying, well, we have to do this. We have to stand up to Assad because Iran is watching and we don't want to be perceived as weak. Well, maybe we do. I mean, like, I know the assumption is, well, I know the assumption is if you think we're weak, you'll be more inclined to do something else. But maybe you want to be underestimated. And then we can surprise them when we actually respond to something that they do. So anyway, the obvious parallel here is for Ronald Reagan, who like made the peace through strength thing, you know, obviously, you know, famous. But is Barack Obama Reagan? You know, everybody talks about Reagan being this cold warrior, and of course he was, but he also lived through Vietnam and I think was very cognizant that we didn't want to become bogged down in another Vietnam, that America didn't have the stomach for it, that we needed to get some wins under our belt and to restore sort of optimism and hope in America after the doldrums of the Carter years and Watergate and Vietnam and all that. And so Reagan avoided, to a large extent, you know, invasions and whatnot. You had like Grenada, you had Lebanon where he withdrew. But basically there weren't a lot of boots on the ground. But there were things like bombing Libya. And, let me throw it to you, Bill. I mean, in a sense, is Barack Obama following the Ronald Reagan model, Not the George W. Bush model, but the Ronald Reagan model here.
I mean, perhaps some parallels there. My sense is with Reagan that, and I haven't read enough about Reagan's foreign policy yet, so I'm speaking from a little bit of a disadvantage point, but I've read a little bit. I mean, Lebanon, for example, was just not a well thought out operation. Period. That I have read about that. I mean, that was just a mess. Grenada was, you know, a pretty small operation. I mean, that was sort of an easy win under the belt. But I don't think it was an operation with a lot with great strategic import. And Libya, I agree, it was certainly short of let's have a full-fledged war with Libya with boots on the ground. I suppose a little bit debatable whether those surgical strikes had the intended effect or not. I am not knowledgeable enough to know how, obviously it didn't oust him from power, and I assume that was not the goal. You know, did it actually deter the terrorism he was sponsoring? And I still don't know enough about the chronology. Obviously, I know his terrorism tapered off. I'm not 100% sure whether the strikes are credited with that, but it well could have been. I'm sure folks in the comments might know more than me and add there. But I mean, those three examples don't strike me as coming from, too organized a foreign policy vision.
But it's also not what you do, it's what you don't do.
Right.
Sometimes it makes for a successful presidency.
Oh, and I agree with you that, you know, I think Vietnam was still on the back of everyone's mind at that point, and there was great reluctance to do, you know, full-fledged boots on the ground, you know, war in these situations. I totally agree. And certainly, you know, Reagan was able to come out of all of it seeming like a strong warrior, you know, despite, you know, a real debacle in Lebanon. It did not besmirch his stature on the world stage. It didn't hamper his negotiations with the Soviets, and to some extent,
it may have also. But I mean, you know, look, and I think to me Reagan gets a pass because he wanted to beat the Soviet Union. He did, and that's a big that was his focus. But I think Bin Laden said that, you know, they saw what happened in Lebanon and they thought, well, America's, you know, they don't have the stomach.
Well, so I mean, there may have been some repercussions because of that down the road, but it's very speculative. You don't know exactly what was going on in Bilan's mind.
I remember I was alive when Reagan bombed Libya. I mean, I don't know all the details. I just know, like, I thought, like, the general sense that I got and everyone around me got was that, like, Reagan was awesome and he was just showing that he means business and putting people back in line, and it was like restoring a belief that America was a powerful force. So I think it had a really strong psychological impact, whether or not it had, you know, a deeper impact.
Well, but this speaks to how ephemeral memories are. I mean, people were not obviously that verklempt about Lebanon. I mean, that happened before he won re-election. He won re-election in a massive landslide. And he still was able to, still show, you know, foreign policy bravado after that point. You know, Obama's had lots of big wins. I mean, he did oust Gaddafi. He did get bin Laden. But it's not like that
Don't
is...
Don't forget the Somali pirates.
And the Somali pirates. But it's not like because of that, everyone's saying, well, he did those things, he's going to wipe the floor with Syria. I mean, people still have the same anxiety that this is going to be, you know, way too convoluted situation for anyone to be able to triumph. I don't know if you were saying this or not. We talk about saving face. I don't think Obama's doing this for save face reasons or for machismo reasons. I mean, if anything, there's massive risk to his legacy to do this. I was always one to say that I never thought Bush Jr.'s Iraq War stemmed from political considerations. I never thought there was, you know, he's just doing this to distract us from the economy. I never bought into conspiracy theories like that because war is a massive risk and it could go incredibly wrong. And anyone with like a modicum of political experience knows that that's not your shortcut to glory.
So what about the argument? I agree with you on that. But what about the argument that it was like a personal vendetta against Hussein for trying to kill his dad?
I mean, I think we have a couple of stray comments that speak to that, but far from enough information to conclude like that was the reason, and that completely colored all everyone's thinking. I mean, I think we know enough to know there are plenty of people stocked in that administration that had other types of geopolitical agendas that were pushing this for a host of reasons. Maybe that was a psychological factor in Bush's mind that tipped the scales in one way, but I would think it's way oversimplifying to say that he bit all his chips on that.
There could be analogies too. I mean, do we know? I don't want to sound conspiratorial here, but I mean, do we know that the chemical weapons came from Assad? I mean, there are rumors that it could be the rebels.
I know, like, that's been pushed out a little bit, and you
talking
know,
about a WMD sort of situation here, where we could get involved, and then it turns out that we had faulty intelligence.
Well, and I think the lesson of Hussein and WMD is that what seems to be very obvious. I mean, the argument is like, what other possible explanation could there be for Saddam Hussein's behavior that he's sitting on this massive stockpile? Well, it turns out his explanation was he was conducting a massive bluff that he didn't get called on. And who could have known at the time that that was the case? So I raised the point to say it probably isn't sufficient to say, well, what other explanation could there be but Assad did it? Yes, it's the most obvious explanation, but sometimes unobvious explanations turn out to be true. That burden's going to be on the Obama White House to make the case, and so it doesn't.
It's
help
actually
him.
Not the most. It's actually not the most obvious, though. But if you buy the notion that Assad was winning, well, and why would he use the chemical weapons? Why would he want to draw America into it if he was winning?
Well, the argument that I've read, I'm sure from the article that I saw it in. So forgive me for not having the recall, but. The argument would be that he thought he had the leeway, that he has already done a small scale chemical weapons attack and not been called on it, and thought that America was too reluctant to get involved militarily in the situation, and perhaps that it was not planned to be as devastating an attack as it was. There was maybe more of an intent to be incremental about the use of it, and this went a couple notches too far and raised more hackles than they were expecting. And there's a third argument that perhaps it was not Assad directly making the order, but some perhaps his brother or somebody else lower level who was acting independently. So there's lots of other. I mean, it's. I think it's harder to make the case that the rebels are sitting on a stockpile of chemical weapons to work with.
Let me give you a very obvious analogy that you probably find a way to tie in when you write this column about Wilson and Obama. is the connection with chemical weapons, with World War One, and here we are. I mean, wouldn't you say that, in a sense, it's illogical that we're so concerned about chemical weapons, but perfectly okay with, like, mowing down people with machine guns. But we do have this aversion to chemical weapons for a variety of reasons, including the experience in World War One. So I'll leave it at that. I mean, that's probably an obvious connection, but maybe you find a way to work it into your little column at
that. Well, do you want to segue out of Syria and talk about a few other things where we have to wrap up?
Well, I would, but it would be, you know, if we could find... You don't announce the segue. It kills the segue. But no, I had one more thing I wanted to talk about.
I am a mood killer.
Yeah, you gotta woo me a little bit here.
I'm just back from vacation. I'm not on my A game.
Yeah. So I'm working on a little blog post idea, and I thought maybe you could help me with it.
Okay.
I'm gonna kick this around a little bit. So I basically have three points that I want to make. The first is obviously that this whole Miley Cyrus twerking thing.
Before you go into this, you explain the dancing bears? I don't get the bears.
I don't get it either. I mean, this is beyond me. Maybe someone could tell us in the comments. I mean, I was pleased to see that, like, you know, you saw the Will Smith family shocked by this.
I was actually in response to Lady Gaga, not Miley Cyrus.
You know how these things go, Bill. It's almost irrelevant. It really is. It's gone down in history that this was a response to Miley Cyrus. So that's, you know, it's a fact.
History is written by the winners.
It really is. So first of all, I'm a little bit surprised and pleased to see that generally people have sort of condemned Miley Cyrus. I mean, I remember when Madonna came on the scene and did things at MTV Awards, like A Virgin, which were seen at the time to be salacious. And she was sort of regarded as this, like, creative, brilliant, pal, she's pushing the envelope. So I'm a little bit surprised and happy to see this sort of pushback. Now, simultaneous, while you have, like, you know, MTV and Miley Cyrus doing this, pushing the envelope sexually, you have shows like Breaking Bad, which I'm a big fan of, which are incredibly violent. And they're like, this is considered the golden age of TV. Megan McArdle at Bloomberg recently sort of explained why we're attracted to these shows that are so dark. And essentially it's because we've removed all the risk from our lives. We've limited the risk in our lives in the 21st century. And so we have this vestigial or, I don't know, innate desire to have excitement. We're finding that desire on TV. So essentially you have, like, we're pushing the violence envelope. We're pushing the sexual envelope. In the case of the Miley Cyrus thing, though, the public has turned against it. And here's the big question. The WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment, I know I'm throwing a lot of pop culture stuff out here, but they got to a point where they were, like, uber violent, uber sexual, and they actually toned it down. And when they toned it down, they got more popular. And now, like, if someone starts bleeding, it's a big deal because it doesn't happen every day. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if we are going to reach a cyclical point, because the assumption has always been that TV and violence and sexuality would just get more and more graphic. And I wonder if it's, though, if we're starting to reach a point where you're going to see the market drive people to be less violent and less graphic. And if that happens, I think it's a really it's a really interesting argument that sort of that the market works. But, you know, this is a big, interesting topic, I know. I'd love to hear from our commenters. I did not prep you with this, but I throw this out to you.
I can bring it. I can respond.
Yeah, and maybe I can steal some ideas for my column.
Right. No, I can't. I mean, there's 2 points there that I would just probably do. One, the Madonna comparison. I think the big difference between Madonna and Miley Cyrus is that Madonna is a talented performer, and Miley Cyrus is a train wreck. So I think if you are doing something that is artistically skilled, like singing and dancing, for example, and you are doing provocative, there are provocative sexual themes within that, you then get applauded for pushing the envelope artistically.
But I would argue Miley Cyrus is talented. I mean, she was.
That was not evident at the MTV Awards.
She does this acoustic version of Dolly Parton's Jolene, which is quite good. I mean, she's not untalented.
Well, when anything you do in a studio, I think, has to be separated from what you do on stage. There's lots of ways you make something look good in the studio. But you see this with a lot of teenage performers, they get on stage for live performance and you find out, you know what, they can't actually sing. At the most basic level, they're not singing on key. Nor are they dancing particularly well. There's nothing going on here that is technically proficient and enjoyable to watch.
I think it's fair to say that Madonna was a very special talent.
Right, exactly. And so I think, and you know, rightly or wrongly, I think that gives you, just like in sports, you know, if you're a Michael Jordan, you can do amazing things with a basketball in the air, the ref's going to give you that extra half step on the way to the hoop. I think the same thing happens, you know, with artistic performers. And that part of that is maybe unfair or illogical, and part of it is... you have earned the right to push the envelope because you have worked on your talent.
Right, but when Madonna came, I think it was Dick Clark, actually, who introduced her, on TV, doing Like a Virgin. She hadn't, at that point, earned this. I mean, she was pushing the envelope, and she was young at the time, maybe not as young as Miley Cyrus, but... It's not like she had like paid her a bunch of dues. She was using, you know, pretty transparently selling sexuality. Yes, her voice was good, but like, you know, I don't know that it was all that. I mean, it was certainly, avant-garde, but I don't know that it was like a brilliant commentary on society.
I don't think she
waltzing around in a wedding dress or whatever.
But I don't think she got the same kind of artistic accolades at that point that she did later on in her career. Once she showed that she was more than just a one-trick pony, then, you know, the more highbrow, you know, literary, you know, artistic praise, you know, came forth. Secondly, I don't even think Miley Cyrus is pushing the envelope. But what is she doing here that's actually pushing? What is she showing me that I haven't seen like a zillion times in other venues? I mean, it's not even like she is like enriching my view of cultural sexuality. It's a literal train wreck, and therefore I think she's asking for more criticism because she's not enriching anything in the process. She's not breaking taboos that needed to be exposed.
Is that the definition? I mean, I agree with that, but I would have said that about Madonna. That, like, you know, I guess the difference is that the taboos have been broken. So somebody now would have to actually really have, like, come out completely naked and have sex before they would actually be like making an artistic statement because we've gone that far.
Madonna's statement, in effect, if you look over the course of her career, was an ownership of her sexual choices. You know,
what's funny is the dichotomy oftentimes between her imagery and her lyrics. What's the one line? Something is the key to my heart, but you need to start with my head. Satin sheets are very romantic. What happens when you're not in bed? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got Cherish. You've got Papa Don't Preach, like an anti-abortion song, essentially. So a lot of her lyrics were in fact, pretty positive. not all of them. A Material Girl is obviously not something we want to like espouse. But I mean, a lot of her lyrics were pretty positive.
I think that's more of a one-off song. I don't think that. But you look at the canon of Madonna. I think there is a thread there.
I'm a fan of her entire catalog here, Bill. Let's not pretend otherwise. No, but I mean, like, seriously, a lot of her lyrics were very positive, but juxtaposed against the obvious, you know, selling of sexuality.
But I mean, you get to pick and choose. You have to look at the whole can and say, what does this body of work mean? It doesn't mean anything. You know, is there actually, you know, import culturally to what the body of work is? And I think with Madonna, there is. She played a role in communicating to the public that when you are a woman, you have the same kind of sexual desires that a man does, and you can make the same kind of choices about when and where and how to have sex. That does not make you.
So why isn't Miley making that same? But why isn't Miley get credit for that then?
I don't. I maybe someone's make the case. I don't see it in what she did. Maybe someone's make the argument. They can go right ahead. I mean, I just didn't see that as any. I mean, this is the beginning of her adult canon, if you will. So perhaps she will surprise me soon enough. I mean, this just struck me as simply, what can I do to get a lot of YouTube clicks? And that's it. I don't see any kind of underlying message of import.
So do you think there's a chance that TV and that we will begin sort of policing ourselves for the just because of the profit motive to start dialing back some of this stuff like WWE has done? Do you think that it keeps getting more and more graphic?
Yeah, I think that there is no market. There's a slew of niche markets. And, you know, I'm at an age, I'm an old man, I don't understand what the dancing bears are, that's evidence of proof of my old age, that I'm tired of violence in media. I'm tired of graphic sexuality. I feel I have seen it. I'm not a bad person for having seen it. I don't need to see it over and over again. That does not excite or interest me anymore. So just seeing it for its shock value doesn't do anything for me. I'd rather see, you know, smartly written dialogue or interesting music.
Well, this goes to Breaking Bad. I mean, I think that. Do you watch? Are you a fan?
I have not watched. I saw the pilot, and I didn't prioritize the show. I tend to catch up on shows like 5 years after the fact.
Right. Well, Netflix has sort of, you know, really made it easy to do that. It's streaming on Netflix, and that's how I've gotten into it. It's smart. It's very smart, and it's very good, and it's incredibly tense, I think.
See, I think that's why I haven't prioritized that. I don't need a lot of tense. That's not what I need in my leisure time.
Well, but no, I think it's actually... okay, so like the tenseness that, you know, mostly, thank God, mostly like my sort of tenseness in life is like, I got too many emails to answer. I got a tweet. And so watching somebody else be tense about something, a life or death situation, is sort of strangely cathartic, you know? I think that's what Megan McArdle was sort of getting at, that there is something pleasurable because we don't live in a world where every day we're fighting for our literal lives, that there's something pleasurable that we get from watching people who are. Maybe that's a bad impulse. But
right. No, that makes perfect sense. But just to get back to your original point, I think there is based on my personal experience, but I think that might have some larger relevance. As you get older, those types, you know, the shock value type of entertainment gets less and less shocking to you, and therefore you move on to other things. So far it seems like as an adolescent, that evolution, the next generation of adolescents doesn't evolve from the previous generation of adolescents. You want to be shocked in the same way at that age because you're just becoming exposed to culture for early in your life. So I don't think you're going to see this nationwide backlash because generationally the next crop adolescents is going to still want this kind of stuff.
Well, a little bit, but I think it's different, Bill. I think our kids... I mean, it's not like our kids are going to spend the first 10 years, you know, or 20 years of their lives watching I Love Lucy. I mean, they're going to, whether we like it or not, have access to some pretty intense stuff pretty early in their lives. So hopefully they won't, you know, fetishize the pushing of the envelope the way that we did, because they're going to see that it's pretty much pushed by the time they get there. I would venture to say it's going to be really, it would be almost impossible to raise a child who, by the time they're 10, hasn't seen some sort of hardcore pornography, unless you really become a separatist and go hardcore into, like, you know, cutting off iPads, TV, cell phones, visiting with friends. I think it's going to be pretty hard to avoid that, even in the best of families where you make every effort. It's not like stumbling upon, you know, your friend's dad's Playboys in the garage. I mean, it's a matter of, like, one kid has seen it, and he has an iPad, and he shows every other kid. So I don't know that they're going to that they're sort of going to, you know, be enamored by, oh, it's really pushing the edge to the degree that we were.
Right. I mean, and I think as you and I as youngish parents who haven't had to face these issues just yet, I mean, I think it's healthy for us to recognize that we are just not in control of the entire culture. Like, there's just no way you're going to keep your kid in a hermetically sealed bubble and not see these things earlier than you would wish they would see them. They're going to see it, and you got to think about how you want to guide them through that process, then expect you're going to be able to completely seal them off from all these things, because it's just not going to happen.
And that, of course, is its own podcast. That's a whole conversation. Well, welcome back, Bill. Welcome back. I'll sing that just like I sang my Madonna. And by the way, somebody please grab the clip of me reciting Madonna lyrics and tweet that out. That needs to live on forever. My colleagues here will have a lot of fun shaming me with that.
We haven't made a lot of DMZ gifts.
We haven't. It's easy to do. You know, you can just do the timestamp thing as well. So do that and mock us at will and leave your comments. And welcome back, Bill. Thanks for another delightful conversation in the DMZ.
I will talk to you next week.
All right.